mother and I, or maybe I just heard this for the first time and it really, really set in, that my youngest two boys do not like cooked apples. And we learned this at Beacon Skiff, sitting at the table when I'm saying to them, "You guys want a slice of apple pie? Ew, no. Would you like a apple dumpling? Side of ice cream? Ew, no. What about apple crisp? Ew, no." I was like, who are you people? And also, who are you going home with? Can you imagine that? North Central New York, or upstate New York, right? And they don't like cooked apples. If you are one of those people, that's okay. I just do not accept that any of them are in my home or in my family. I can't accept that. Also, my wife is a baker. My son's taken up bacon too, and we're having fun with it. But I'm praying that their tastes change. Actually, another dad told me that's actually super helpful because now all the apple desserts are unaccounted for, really. There's going to be more for dad, but I don't need more apple crisp. So we're so grateful you're here today. Our kids just slipped off and away into Kids Central. We're so grateful for all the work our kids workers are doing. If you're a teacher, assistant teacher, helper on a regular basis or ever, thank you. Thank you so much for spending time with our children. We're so grateful that you are. If you're new to our church family or you're watching in on our live stream, my name is Dan. It's my honor to serve as the lead pastor here, and also I get the privilege of sharing the main message every week, and that comes from the scriptures. We're tackling a series today called Who Does Jesus Think He Is? And it turns out Jesus thinks he is I Am, and he finishes that statement that identifies himself as the Old Testament God of creation, the Yahweh God, by using the phrase I Am, where God, of course, introduces himself as I am who I am, and then later Jesus uses the I am statements to say I am who I am, God himself, and specifically I am, and then there's several descriptors that will, or metaphors that we'll look at in our series and touch on a little bit earlier. We're in a topic today that is incredibly important, and really, there is a theological position that is going to be in conflict with what we say today, and the theological position is actually called a theologian's opiate. And the theological position of an opiate is it's this idea. And you know what? I'm going to take a quick little shout out to somebody. Would somebody grab my remote control there? You know who never said that ever while they were preaching? Jesus. Jesus never said, "Hold on, could you grab my remote control?" Oh, no, it's right on my chair there. Yeah. So would you give him a hand? It's just like, it's like Peter and John, you know, who were close to Jesus, always had his technical tools that they were providing for him. This idea of a theological opiate. A theological opiate is this idea that everyone, it's this theological idea that everyone is going to be in heaven one day. The theological opiate is that everyone who you've ever known and loved is looking down on you from heaven. And the reason why it's an opiate is because that is a theological position that makes someone feel pretty good, right? Isn't it rewarding? I got to tell you, as a pastor, preacher, person who does weddings and funerals, wouldn't you imagine that it's way much easier to tell everybody all the time that the person that they loved is in heaven, looking down, and that you can say that about everyone all the time? I mean, no matter how rotten people really knew they were, you could still say, "Hey, God's merciful and they're looking down from heaven," right? That is the opiate of the theologian to say, this is true. The problem is Jesus doesn't agree. The problem is Jesus doesn't believe that to be true. And so despite how much better we feel about the inclusiveness of, I'm good here. Whoa, look at that. Despite how good we feel about that, our Christian message being our loving God made plans for everyone to be in heaven with Him, despite how good it feels to say that no one will be punished, no one will be separated from God, no one will be left behind, this is really the way that we wish it was, probably. I mean, by the way, if you have any compassion, I think, the preacher's going to tell you something that it's hard to hear today. If you have any compassion, you ought to wish that's true. Really, you ought to wish that's true. Nobody should believe that some people are separated from God and some people aren't and feel really good about it. Really, nobody should feel that way. What's God's will? It's God's will that none should perish. That's what He desires, that none would perish. It's also the way we want the world to be. We want the world to be accepting, and we want the world to be inclusive, and we want the world to be fair, right? It's also, as a church leader, it's also a better way to win people over. Isn't that a more winsome message to say, hey, you know what we believe? We believe that you just eventually everybody ends up in God's presence in heaven because He loves everybody. He's so compassionate that everyone, in the end, everyone wins, or as Rob Bell put it, love wins, right? It's a more winsome message. Isn't that a easier message around the Thanksgiving table than having a family conflict and you say, sorry, all of you who don't believe, you better wear shorts where you're going because it's going to be hot. That's it's a divisive, painful message. But the belief that God exists to help us behave better and feel better is called moralistic therapeutic deism. That is, that we believe there's a God, but His primary purpose is to help us do better and feel better. And it makes sense that we would take this opiate of this theological opiate and we would agree with it and we would like it and we would share it with people and that we would affirm people. But is that what Jesus really tells us? That's not what He tells us. So today we're going to take the bitter pill of something called exclusivism. And it's invented by God and it's perpetrated or it's replicated and it's reset and it's perpetuated by Jesus in how He describes Himself to be. And you have to really take Jesus' words in His own description of Himself, right? Because it's too risky to take other people's words for it. It's too risky to base your entire eternal salvation on what someone else says about Jesus. And that's the premise of our series here, is that we get to see and savor Jesus for who He says He is, not what someone else says He is. And the best way for us to do that is to listen to how Jesus describes Himself. So who does He think He is? Who does Jesus think He is? The I am sayings of Jesus, He describes Himself as the bread of life, the light, the door, the good shepherd, the resurrection, the way, and the truth, or the vine. And we're going to hit all those. Today we're on I am the door. And He's telling us something about Himself, profoundly important. And He's revealing some things about Himself that help us see His glorious character. And also the I am statements give us a motivation to worship Jesus. Listen, if Jesus said, I am an important historical figure, you don't have to worship Him. If Jesus said, I am a really, really great prophet, important prophet, along with all the other prophets, but really super important, we don't have to worship Him. If Jesus said, I am a significant historical religious teacher who teaches with moral authority, we don't have to worship Him. But Jesus didn't say those things. What Jesus said actually compels us to worship Him for who He is as the I am. And then we get to see Him and savor Him for who He really is and live a life of worship. So who does Jesus think He is? Here's our big idea today. Jesus thinks He is the only door a person enters into the people of God, and the people of God are those whom he knows, those whom he saves, and those whom he protects, right? So get this. Jesus thinks that there's a door. He is the door, and a person enters that door into the people of God, and that the God of those people knows them, saves them, and protects them as his flock. And here's how Jesus says it. In John chapter 10, we can look at this together. By the way, if you're taking notes, we have this clever little tool for you on our church app. Also something Jesus never said while he was teaching. If you go to our church app, you'll find a tab called Sunday Notes or Sunday Messages, and in the notes, there's a digital outline. You can fill in the blank. You can fill in the fields. You can email it to yourself so you can have one of the greatest sermons you've ever heard for the rest of your life. You can keep it right on file for yourself. So we're looking in John chapter 10. He's teaching, Jesus is teaching about himself and why he came. If you're in the book of John, here's what you're learning. You're learning who Jesus is and why he's significant. You're learning who he is and you're learning why he's significant if you're in the book of John, because that's what the Gospel of John is about. So in verse 9 in chapter 10, here's what he says. Jesus says, "Yes, I am the gate." Let me stop there because this is important to give you some perspective here. When you hear the gate, when you hear the word gate, you don't have the same response as Jesus' hearers. Jesus' hearers would hear the word gate and it would be loaded with significance. The word gate was a metaphor that was very, very common and vibrant in ancient communities, and when they heard this word gate, they would have kind of come alive. And Jesus is using this metaphor that has been used centuries earlier by the psalmist, and the psalmist wrote about it all the way back in Psalm 118. If you're taking notes, jot this down. Look what the psalmist writes about the gate. Here's what he says: "These gates lead to where? The presence of the Lord." So it's Jesus saying he's the gate, and the hearers, you know what they hear? Because they've studied this Torah, they've studied the literature of the Old Testament, they have studied the poems and the songs of the Psalms, and check out what they say. These gates lead specifically to the presence of the Lord. What does that mean? It is the mutual, inside the presence here, inside through this gate, here's what the psalmist is describing, the mutual intersection between God and his people. It's a place here, the gates that lead to this particular place, they are the location, they're the flock where God's people are, where they are a joy-filled people who are filled with worship. And they are there giving thanks to God for their salvation and security. And the psalmist is saying, these are the gates, and the godly, they enter this gate, and when they get there, they are among the congregation of God, singing and praising and worshiping and thanking God with joy-filled hearts because they are his people and they belong to him in this particular congregation where God and his people are intersecting together through this gate. So Jesus goes on to say, yes, I'm the gate. Centuries before the psalmist wrote about the gate, I'm the gate. And my people, those who come in through me, what will they experience? They will be saved. And these people will enter my flock. They will enter my pasture. They will enter my family. Now, keep this in mind. Jesus is telling them in context here in the Gospel of John, Jesus is telling them they're going to enter through me. They're not going to enter through the prophets. It doesn't matter which prophet, how successful, how anointed, how powerful, how well-received. These are heroes of our faith, but Jesus is saying you don't enter God's presence through the prophets. You certainly don't enter through pretenders, people who are politicians, people who are religious leaders, people who are wise teachers in the past. None of these particular people who are judges or kings, they are not going to help you get through this gate into the presence of God. Jesus is also comparing himself to those who said, you enter the presence of God by following the rules. The Pharisees who taught, you are accepted and approved and justified before God by following the rules. Jesus is saying, it isn't through pretenders, it isn't through prophets, And it's not through your performance. Instead, he says, through me. I am the gate. That's how you're going to end up. Where? In the good pastures, where there's life and joy and nourishment, where there is goodness and thanksgiving. And this idea that Jesus is drawing his flock in through the gate. He's not leading his flock out of the gate among a whole bunch of different flocks. He's taking the Jews and the Gentiles and say, you enter through this gate and you're going to enter into my flock, my family, good pastures, the safety of the fold. It's a luxurious pasture of joy and freedom and security. By the way, Jesus won this freedom and security as a shepherd, not one who was taking his staff and he was kind of like winning with the sword or winning with a weapon. Jesus won this freedom and security by a cross, and we will see that later on in the Gospels, of course. So Jesus says, I am the gate, and those who come in through me will be saved. Now, did you know that most people, Barna Research and a whole bunch of other professionals in the field of research, they've noted that a significant number of people who identify themselves as Christians believe there is more than one way to heaven. I don't know if you knew that. You probably did, because if you just kind of, it's easy to believe that, number one, right? It's like opiate. Number two, it seems so much more fair. Number three, unless you're willing to kind of take a harsh position, then this is kind of a more a less harsh position to take. But studies reveal that most Christians, significant numbers of Christians, significant numbers of people believe there's more than one way to heaven. Now, this is the, you may have heard it put this way. Look, we're all climbing the same mountain in a different path, but eventually we all reach the same summit. That's how it would sound. Hey, I'm okay with whatever path you take. I've just kind of accepted that you take your path, I take my path. Relativism, right? You take your path, I take my path. And eventually we all make our way up to the top of the mountain and we see each other. Oh, we're in heaven. There we are. We all made it. That's how it would sound, really. And the only way to enter the flock, though, according to Jesus, is through Jesus. So what does that mean? There's three things this means that I've given you in your notes today. Three things this means. Number one, there are not many paths or doors to God. That's what it means. So Jesus is saying, I'm the gate. And by saying I'm the gate, you know what he's also saying? There's not many other paths or doors to heaven. Now, if you believe there are many paths to heaven or many gates or doors to enter into God's presence for eternity, there's words for that. Here's two of them that I want you to see. One is religious pluralism, and that means that all religions have equal value and are equally valid. All worldviews are the same. They might have some uniquenesses, right? Islam and Christianity, they both believe in one God, but they're a little bit different here and there, but they're all valid. They're all basically worth in validating or accepting. That you accept yours, I accept mine. We all accept one another's, and we eventually all see each other at the top of the mountain. That would be religious pluralism, equally valid or acceptable. The second word is universalism. That is the idea that God has created all creatures, and according to his plan, eventually all the creatures will be with him in heaven again. That is that all living creatures will come to a final salvation. That's in God's plan. And by the way, that if any creature didn't come into the final salvation with God, that would destroy God's plan. So it's impossible. So he created everything, human beings specifically, to spend an eternity with him in heaven. That means universalism. There's whole entire sects of religions that are devoted to universalists, universalism. So there's two categories that might be helpful that Jesus is saying, here are two things that can't be true if I'm the gate. It's impossible. So now, if you believe that Jesus is the gate, if you believe that there is a single door to God and it's Jesus, do you know what you are? You're an exclusivist. You're an exclusivist. So philosophically, if you're not a universalist or if you're not a religious pluralist, you would be an exclusivist. And there is a reason why someone is an exclusivist. That's because they believe that there's one true path or gate to get to heaven, and that person is Jesus. Now, famous atheists, you may remember George Carlin, comedian. Nod your head if you remember him. Do you remember him? I want to see who's older than 50 in the room. Yep. Or I think it actually also might be Bill Maher, the comedian, I think atheist comedian. But it's a famous atheist who said, do you know what it is about Christianity that makes it so toxic? Because I always think to myself, why is it perceived that Christianity is so toxic? What other faith says that you love your enemies? What other faith says that the last are first? What other faith says to lift up those in justice, those who are marginalized, stepped on, and powerless? What other faith advocates that if you lose your life, you gain it? What other faith advocates such selfless, love God with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength, and also love others as yourselves? That's evidence of loving God. What other faith is like that? And I always think to myself, why is it trendy to hate Christians? And B, why is it so popular to call Christianity toxic? Well, these atheists describe it this way. They say, what makes Christianity so toxic is its exclusivity. It's the idea that it's the Christians who say all of this about their religion, but you can only enjoy and enter this religion or this heaven or this flock of God if you go through one single gate, the person of Jesus. And then I go, I get it. You know why? Because most of us are moralistic therapeutic deists, and that doesn't feel good. Most of us like the opiate sensation of everybody's in. Don't sweat it. They're looking down on us. Don't worry. Don't matter. They probably had really good intentions and so on. That's why. So that makes sense to me. Does that make sense to you? That's why it's so toxic? Because we're telling people, sorry, your way, not good enough. Our way, that's the winner. That doesn't feel good. You know, I know how people make me feel when they say, oh, the Red Sox are better than the Yankees. I feel like, don't be dumb. Don't be so toxic. It's so toxic, right? Isn't it? Secondly, this is how Jesus describes this. Look at this. Does Jesus, let me ask you this question. When Jesus says he's the gate, when he says that there's not many paths or doors, are we getting him wrong? I mean, are we like misinterpreting? Are we kind of like, I'm not sure you're hearing Jesus exactly, or if you did some study. Well, Jesus actually describes what he meant in Matthew. In the book of Matthew, here's what he says. He says, you can enter God's kingdom only through the narrow gate. The highway to hell is what? Broad. And its gate is wide for the many who choose that way. Narrow. Look at this. The gateway to life is very narrow. The road is difficult and only a few find it. This is different from what I want to say. I want to say to people, no. You just have to want it. You just have to wish. You just have to hope that you're acceptable to God. You just have to kind of have good intentions, and everybody eventually makes it. That's what I want to say. I do, because I have compassion, and I want people to feel good about where they're at and feel good about their future, and I don't want a toxic message. But Jesus says, I'm not a pluralist. Jesus says, I'm not a universalist. Jesus says, I'm an exclusivist, and I'm going to go so far as to say, I am the gate. I am the door. It's narrow. Few will find it. But you know who most people and many people will find? They'll find the wide gate. They'll find the wide path. They're going to wander around from gutter to gutter, from ditch to ditch, from guardrail to guardrail, wandering around this wide, wide path that's acceptable to anybody and everybody. And Jesus is describing, keep that in mind when you're trying to find your way to God. Keep this in mind, that few find it. When they find it, they're gonna notice that it's narrow, and they might even feel like it's toxic. They might even feel like it's impinging on their freedom to tell people what they want to hear. So the only way to enter the flock of God's people is through Jesus. That also means that the door is Jesus. And I gave you this big word, bolded with underlined, alone. That means Jesus plus nothing equals everything. You don't have to add anything to Jesus, right? Now, some of you who might struggle with this idea, I remember preaching a funeral one time for a prominent TV broadcaster, and I'll never forget this. I was preaching, and this, let this be a warning to you. The preacher can see you out there. Let this be a warning to you. While I was sharing this message, and there were like 99% of them were total strangers. So I didn't know the people, I didn't know the family, I didn't know the guests of the funeral, and so I very, very cautiously but boldly with love and compassion was trying to get across that the path to eternal rest is Jesus alone. And every time, this is so amazing, every time I said Jesus, someone directly in the middle of the audience, right in front of me, every time I said Jesus, they went like this. Every time. Every time I said the word Jesus. And she's looking one way or other like, what a moron. Who let this fool in here to tell us all this? She had an adverse reaction. But then I want you to think about this. Think about this. If you went to see the oncologist, and the oncologist said to you, we've discovered cancer. There is treatment for the cancer. And the treatment for the cancer is chemotherapy. How crazy would it be to call the doctor and say, hey, we've decided not to go with the chemotherapy because I've been taking Tylenol and I'm feeling pretty good. I'm actually feeling a lot better. Would it be irresponsible of the oncologist to say, well, that's good news. That's great to hear. I wish you well. Maybe we'll see you again sometime in the future, right? In other words, we get that. We don't think that's crazy. We say, yeah, you've got to do the chemo if that's the treatment, because what are we trying to do? Kill the disease. And the reason why it's Jesus alone, it's because he's the chemotherapy, stick with me, that cures the disease of sin and separation from God. It doesn't matter how many Tylenols and aspirins and other kind of painkillers you take to feel better, or I should put it this way, it doesn't matter how many other worldviews or pathways or philosophies that you follow that make you feel better, because even though you feel better, the chemotherapy is the only thing that addresses the thing that will kill you. It is only Christ crucified, resurrected again, and faith in him and his work that actually cures the disease of sin. But if you don't believe there's a disease of sin, you're not going to need the chemotherapy. You just keep taking the Tylenol. You just keep taking the whatever makes you feel better. Does that make sense? So when we're talking about the exclusivity of Jesus, what we're talking about is he is the only one who has the power to mortify, to lay in its grave death, and to overcome this grave by raising from the dead. He's the only one that actually cures the sin of the sickness of sin, death, and the grave. And that's why when we say Jesus alone, we have to say I'm exclusivist, because these other world religions, no matter how compelling they are or popular they are, or philosophies that seem to be more fair and just and the path is wider, it doesn't really address the disease, even if it makes you feel better. And it's important to know. So let me give you four trapdoors, okay? So here's four doors that look like a path to God, but they're traps. They won't open. When it's time for you to enter into God's final rest and presence, these don't open. And it's this door here, the religion door. If you're trying to enter into God's presence for eternity and be in his flock, we'll say, the religion door says, I am here based on my good work alone. I'm here by my efforts, my good deeds. I've done good things for people. who didn't even deserve it, and I did it. And here's what we know, that the Scripture teaches us in the Christian faith here, and Jesus is saying the religion door is not going to open. It's not going to give you access. The second one is the righteousness door, my behavior alone. Here's the thought, that if I really take care of my inner purity, then God, I'm going to be able to justify myself before God. That I could present to God my righteousness, and he'll say, you've been justified, and now you can be a part of my family, entering God's flock through good behavior. Now, we've noticed that in the Scriptures, that's condemned, right? The condemnation is that these people, they have the outward purity, but they lack the inner power of Jesus, Christ crucified, a regeneration by faith. Thirdly, the faithfulness door. This is someone who is trying to get in through the good attendance. I've always been a Christian. I would never waver from that. This is the person who is kind of trying to enter into the flock by their devotion alone. To them, they believe their devoted church membership and attendance is going to matter supremely, even above the fact that there might be some unfruitful spiritual immaturity that might even indicate there is no new life, new heart. But this person would say, I'm so faithful, I never miss, ever since I can remember, I'll always be and I always was, and they base their justification before God on their faithfulness. The fourth trap door here to avoid is the good person door. This is what we see at funerals when we say, I know they're in heaven. Why? Because I knew them and they had such a good heart. They're such good intentions. They always meant well. In fact, I remember one time I was with them going into a store and they held the door for somebody. They would always hold the door for somebody. They had good heart, good intentions. They didn't hurt anybody. The good person says, look, I'm in comparison to other people, I'm not that bad. I mean, I'm watching the news. There's knuckleheads on the news. I ain't that bad. That's what they say. That's what they believe. And they believe that their good intentions are accepted, even if you don't have a genuine faith in Jesus. If you have good intentions, it's good enough. And by entering through the Jesus gate alone, here's what we do. We look at all these doors and we reject them. If you believe that Jesus is the gate, the door, then we look at all these doors and say, we reject them, can't accept them. Pastor, that seems really toxic. I wish it weren't true. I wish it weren't true. I also wish people didn't have to do chemo to get rid of the cancer. Bad things happen. Wish it weren't true. But I'm not a moralistic therapeutic deist. I'm not a universalist. I'm not a religious pluralist. I believe exclusively that this is now. So, church family, can you see why this is the point where some people that are on the fringe looking in say, okay, I'm out. I'm out. I can't do this kind of religion. The religion I'm doing is going to accept everybody equally. And of course we do. We love everybody equally. But the gate to God is through Jesus alone. And if that's true, then we can't accept the other gates. You know, look at that gate over there. It's pretty decent. The good person gate. You know what I'm saying? So next Sunday, this is what we're going to dive into next Sunday. When we embrace Jesus as our joy and treasure, and we enter through him, we become one of God's treasured sheep. If you read anything about sheep, don't read anything about sheep, because it'll be completely insulting to see that God thinks you're a sheep. Sheep are dumb. You know what I mean? There's so much dumbness in the sheep. Don't read it. We're going to look and see that compared to Jesus, who sees himself as our shepherd, here's what we're going to discover. If you're a sheep, you know what you need? You need a shepherd. You know what kind of shepherd Jesus is? The kind who laid his life down for the sheep. We're going to dive into that next week and see that even if you enter through the gate, through the door of Jesus, what you're going to discover is that even though you are wandering and lost and alone and looking for your way in the darkness full of danger, there is a good shepherd, and that good shepherd comes after you. He pursues you and protects you, and then he brings you into his full fold, and in his fold is the congregation of saints, full of joy, singing of his glory and beauty. And he does that for us, not by our merit, but by his grace. Jesus thinks he's the only door a person enters into the people of God whom he knows and saves and protects. Thank God for that. One door, the only door, the narrow gate. Let's pray together. Father, we treasure you today and are so grateful that you have helped us find our way, that you have led us into this gate, door. And we just rejoice about that. We're so relieved. And today, if there's someone listening in the church family here among us or looking in through our live stream, sitting in their own room or in their own car, and they're just sensing this deep drawing and longing to enter through the gate, I pray that you would give them the faith they need to rest their confidence that you are enough, that you are the solution, that you are the door into your presence. God, would you do it by the way you always do, a divine, miraculous transformation in their heart by your Holy Spirit, by giving them a new heart. And for those of us who have gone in through the gate, we pray today that we would cherish that gate, see and savor that gate, that door, Jesus, like never before. That we would have the courage to reject all others that are not the answer, not the solution. And God, as we reject them, would you give us the wisdom of a serpent, the harmlessness of a dove, that we would be gentle, compassionate, as we help people and win people over to the beauty of the one who says, I am the gate, I am the door. For our kids, for our neighbors, for our parents, for our classmates, for our teammates, our co-workers, and everyone beyond, we pray that our message